From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow.
Mark, Eric, welcome. I've been looking forward to this all week. It's a pleasure, as always, to speak with you.
Oh, you flatter us.
Don, Eric, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I will third that motion.
All right, so let's start with Syria. We're going to try to cover a number of things, including Syria, what's going on in Korea, the Brexit that's not a Brexit, and what's happening in Venezuela. We'll start with Syria. Mark, you're up.
Yeah, okay, so we left off last week discussing the unlikely possibility of a ceasefire that was tentatively, or at least a pause, I think it was characterized, a pause in fighting, that was agreed to last week and was supposed to take effect this Friday. I think we all agreed that it wasn't going to happen, and sure enough, it didn't happen. Right now, the most important thing perhaps during the week, other than Saudi and Turkey continuing to bang drums about invasion, which didn't happen, we saw Turkey shelling basically continuously across the border into Syria, and also launching airstrikes against Kurdish forces in Iraq. There was a terrorist bombing, two terrorist bombings in Turkey, both ostensibly against military targets. There was initial blame from the Turkish government accusing the PKK, then accusing the Syrian government. And after about 2 days after the incident, an obscure Kurdish PKK splinter group that evidently has supposedly centered from and severed ties from the PKK, but basically no one has ever heard of before December of last year, claimed responsibility for the attacks. I'm still a little bit questionable on the veracity of that. Certainly Erdogan beat the drums to war against Syria, claiming the right to self-defense, and was already making further noises about a safe line in Syria. But we haven't seen that materialize yet because it seems that Obama is hemming and hawing he's still hoping to lead from behind while Saudi and Turkey are both trying to put the U.S. in front of an invasion of Syria. So because of that, I think we've been spared it thus far. There was a Security Council resolution put forward by Russia, largely in response to the shelling of Syria by Turkey, an act of war, that called for basically a recognition and verification of Syria's territorial integrity and sovereignty. And the Western countries, the U.S., the U.K., and France, all rejected this in a closed-door meeting. It's not clear if an actual vote was held, but at least six members rejected it of the Security Council, including those three. And they accused Russia of trying to distract the issue by it. Of course, there can be no serious peace negotiations in Syria if the West refuses to even recognize its territorial integrity and sovereignty. The whole idea is ridiculous. Top of all of this, we have behind closed doors meetings about trying to get the ceasefire to actually happen now, taking place between Russia and the U.S. And the most recent news off the Washington Post and Reuters is that the U.S. had a caveat to any potential ceasefire or pause in the fighting, and that is that Russia not only stop its attacks against the, quote, Syrian moderate opposition, but also stop its it's airstrikes against Al-Qaeda. And it must be mentioned that there are two UN Security Council resolutions, 2249 and 2254, specifically calling for the eradication of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and all individuals, entities, and endeavors associated with it. The problem, of course, is that everywhere across the board, from Aleppo to Idlib and beyond, Al-Nusra, which has been recognized by both the U.S. and the U.N. as Al-Qaeda in Syria, is intermingled with the quote-unquote Western-backed proxy opposition. And there is no way to separate them, which basically, according to Russia's and Syria's interpretation, makes all of them legitimate targets for associating with Al-Qaeda. And in a Reuters report that just came off the wires, an anonymous U.S. military official called this the elephant in the room, that the Russia is evidently completely rejecting, and I believe quite rightly so.
Yeah, Hammond as much has admitted that. Let me just play this real quick thing here, because he's describing moderates. He was on BBC on Mars program last Sunday, and this is what he said. Right here.
There's about 150,000 moderate opposition fighters. I wouldn't call them all democratic, but moderate opposition fighters on the ground.
The last of the moderate opposition are holding out in Aleppo right now, and the Russians are pounding them. Are you calling on the Russians to stop right now?
Yes, we are. But just to be clear, that isn't where the last of the moderate opposition are. There are moderate opposition positions there. There are moderate opposition positions in the outskirts of Damascus. There are moderate opposition positions in the south of the country.
So,
I want to try to say moderate opposition positions five times.
Yeah.
Is there a question coming to me, or am I just talking?
Yeah, just pick it up.
Yes.
This is garbage all the way around. I think that there's a couple of things that need to be pointed out here. Number one, the notion of moderate opposition is important because this is not some sort of, it's sophistry, but at the same time, I think that there is a little bit of substance here in the sense that when they say moderate opposition, what they're trying to do is they're trying to basically engage in a rebranding effort here because they need to. They know that the Free Syrian Army really only exists in name, and to varying extents, I suppose, there are still groups that are fighting that are calling themselves that, but the reality is it has been subsumed under the larger umbrella of various jihadi, Salafi, all of these various groups.
And the operations rooms that include... Yeah. Al-Qaeda and its offshoot Jabhat al-Nusra.
And actually, hold on. Let me play this clip too. I've got one more clip, Eric. Let me play this. This is from a spokesperson for President Assad on RT the day before yesterday.
You notice how many words people look for: rebels, insurgents, opposition. Anyone who carries arms against civilians, against government, against institutions is a terrorist. Political opposition should be dealing with politics, should be an opposition against a government, but by political means, without using arms, without killing people, without beheading people. You remember the person who ate the heart of a Syrian soldier? That was from the Free Army, and the Free Army is considered to be moderate by some Western countries. Moderate opposition. Can't terrorism be moderate? Can somebody who is beheading people and killing people and destroying and raping women and attacking minorities in a country, can those be considered moderate? Can those be considered opposition? I want to talk to you in a Western frame of mind. Can Britain or France or the US accept any opposition that carries arms, attacks schools, kills people? I mean, why do they apply terminology on us that does not apply anywhere in the world? You know, this is unacceptable, really.
Okay.
Well, okay. I that's fine. I think that there is, unfortunately, in all sides of this debate, a lack of nuance, I think, because I think that we need to be a little bit more clear about what it is we're talking about. My point that I'm making here is that when they say moderate opposition, they're trying to draw artificial delineations within these groups so that they can be ideologically aligned with what the West really needs to put forward from a public relations perspective. And the reality, as Mark was alluding to, and as was noted in the Washington Post and in all of the mainstream media, this notion of moderate rebels are intermingled with not moderate rebels. And the question is, can you really make a separation between them? This is not to say that every single fighter with a gun in his hands is, you know, eating hearts or is, you know, beheading babies or whatever. That's, of course, not the reality. But many of these groups are connected in ways that I think are difficult to comprehend from a Western perspective. And I think that that's really the point that needs to be made here. And then also,
but Eric, we have always been allied with Al-Qaeda.
I agree with that. We could go 40 years back if we really want to get into that. But I don't know that we have another way of time for that.
Right.
The thing I want to say is this, and I'm not a military tactician or strategist, but if you pay attention to the changes on the battlefield, I think it's pretty clear what's happening here. Most recent reports are that the Syrian government forces and its various militias that are fighting under the NDF banner, they're making significant gains outside of the Latakia area in the Latakia suburbs. This is really important, not only because Latakia is, you know, if you read the Western media, because this is an Alawite stronghold, quote unquote, but also because Latakia is critical. I mean, along the coast, it's also a very important focal point of that north-south corridor that I've talked about a lot, stretching from Idlib in the north all the way down to Daraa in the south.
Also where the Russian air base is.
Where the Russian air base is. So there's a lot of strategic necessity for, look, the Assad forces or the pro-government forces have been more or less in and around Latakia for a long time, but consolidating of control, I think, is important. At the same time, this is all the way, I mean, if you get your mental maps out, that's all the way in the west along the coast. At the very same time, far across the country in the northeast, we now have a report. This I saw, let's see, in Euronews, but I believe it's been reported elsewhere. Headline, ISIL stronghold of al-Shaddadi captured by Kurdish-led forces. Now, if the Kurdish forces, the YPG, and their various smaller subsidiary groups, if they're making gains against the Islamic State in the northeast in Hasaka province and elsewhere along that segment of the country, now you're beginning to see exactly why Erdogan and the Turks are so hell-bent on bombing Kurdish positions, obviously inside of Turkey, but, you know, inside of Syria as well, because they understand that once they've been cut off of those lifelines, those supply lines into Aleppo, it's very difficult for them to be able to provide the kind of resources, financial as well as material resources, to the Islamic State in order to continue this ongoing war. And now that you see the Kurds advancing in that direction, I think it's pretty clear that Erdogan is having meetings in Ankara, basically understanding that his time is running out here. And the more that the Kurds advance, the more that the Russians bomb, the more that the Syrian army advances, all of this, I think, really takes away some of the options that Erdogan has. And I think that that's really why you're seeing this escalation from Turkey in hopes that they can drag the U.S. into it. But as I've said a number of times, and as I said a couple of times this week, including on Crosstalk when I was on this week, I think that it's pretty obvious, at least from my perspective, that certain segments, if not much of the political leadership, political establishment, and the foreign policy establishment in the United States is very hesitant to back Erdogan in any significant way. Sure, they made the stand in the UN Security Council. They can't have they can't be seen siding with Russia against a NATO ally just for public relations and political reasons. But the reality is that they're not exactly providing a significant amount of political cover for the drumbeat of war that Erdogan has been parading around with. So it's
a European members of NATO have outright said we will not go to war with Russia over Erdogan's adventures.
Right. And again, I think that this is the precarious state of this political situation, that on the one hand, Erdogan wants to counter Kurdish and Syrian advances. On the other hand, he can't really do all that much. Now, I want to just pose one other point here, and this is, I think, really critical, because this is something I've talked about a number of times, but let's see, do I have it in front of me? Yes. This is I've talked about the Brookings Institution deconstructing Syria, the notion of carving up the country into sectarian, ethnic-based statelets that could then be more easily manipulated by the West. That strategy, which has been in place for a long time. Now, here we have the report from the RAND Corporation. This is very important, in my opinion, because one of the co-authors, actually maybe two of them, I'm not positive, are considered to be very, very close to Barack Obama, considered very close to the foreign policy establishment surrounding the White House. RAND Corporation white paper, a peace plan for Syria. Okay, now this is the dressing up of the very same agenda, the very same strategy, and this is the carving of Syria. Now, what they're saying is basically there is no alternative between two options. One, creating a political solution with a transition away from Assad, or two, allowing for what they call the decentralization or the devolution of power to the local level. Now, it says very clearly in the RAND Corporation paper, and I would point everybody's attention to it, it says option one, a political solution with a transition away from the Assad government, ain't happening. That the Russians and the Iranians that have made clear that that is not going to happen, and that they're not going to allow the regime to be removed. So the second option then is exactly the same thing the Brookings Institution has been pushing forward. The reason I bring this up is because if you read the RAND Corporation paper, knowing what Brookings has been saying for a long time, you can see where all of this is going. The quote-unquote concession that the policy establishment is ready to make is a concession on regime change. What they are going to demand, though, is that Russia move forward with allowing a quote-unquote ceasefire that allows for these regional quasi-statelets to emerge. This is critical, because what's the Sunni state? Who controls the Sunni state? What role does the Islamic State, ISIS, Daesh, have within the Sunni state? That's where we go back to John Bolton in the New York Times, the neocons pushing for essentially exactly that, legitimizing a caliphate. This is where this is going. This is the tenor of the negotiations moving forward. This is why the U.S. was more assertive in Munich than they ever were in Vienna, because they know that this is now their committed strategy. And I think that's what everyone needs to be focused on.
Mark?
Yeah. Eric, of course, agree with everything Eric has said. And we've talked about these documents a long time and how this is the plan B for the neocons that run the foreign policy establishments of pretty much the entirety of the West right now. When he mentioned the Kurds advancing in the east of the country, the Kurds are also advancing in the west of the country, perhaps even far more importantly, as they advance basically in parallel with the Syrian Arab army around Aleppo. And here they are advancing both against the ISIS forces, ISIL in the area, but they are also advancing against the quote-unquote Syrian opposition backed by the West, including the Free Syrian Army and its allies, al-Nusra. They are moving again. They're closing up this Jarablus corridor, this important, crucially important 100-kilometer stretch that Turkey supplies all of its proxies, and ISIS also resupplies from Turkey into Syria. And this is the big threat. This is where Turkey is shelling. This is why Turkey is committing airstrikes. And in this, Turkey, a NATO member, is not – it's not just Turkey that's attacking a Kurdish forces that are backed by both the U.S. and Russia. But here we directly see a Syrian Democratic Forces. This is the in the last 6 months, the newly rebranded name for the Kurds with a handful of Arab tribes, which the U.S. tried to hitch as their new horse, but which also allied with Russia and the Syrian government. The Syrian Democratic Forces, backed by CENTCOM, that is the Pentagon, are directly fighting the al-Qaeda-allied Free Syrian Army, backed by the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, we have video of quote, Free Syrian Army units, you know, the designated toll holders of al-Qaeda, firing advanced U.S. anti-tank weapons, TOWs, at U.S. Pentagon-backed Kurdish forces. This just highlights the absolute insanity, the absolute lack of any coherent strategy or policy from the White House on what's going on in Syria.
You know, the other thing that I want to say, though, what Mark is saying is true. However, we shouldn't forget that when the Kurds advance into the further into the west, as Mark was alluding to, in particular around Aleppo and you know that general region, that has a lot of strategic value in terms of the battlefield and the shifting battlefield. But when they move east, that has a lot of value in terms of oil, in terms of economic interests. And this is, I think, I don't know which they consider more important, but I think that Turkey and some of these other players are probably equally terrified about the notion that the Kurds are going to more or less seize control of a number of strategic oil reserves. Now, if they're able to do that and position themselves with Russia as an ally, this then means that the Kurds are basically moving towards, if it's not outright independence and or it's de facto autonomy or whatever the hell they're going to call it, is somewhat moot. The point is they're going to have economic resources far outstripping their own political power at any point in the last century. Now, I'm not talking about the Kurds of northern Iraq. We know exactly that's a known quantity. But if the Kurds in Syria now are able to boast some level of oil reserves to back their political power that they're winning on the battlefield, this now makes them a very real political force. Now, how does that translate into the Kurdish minority inside of Turkey who are being bombed by Ankara as we speak? You see, this is the shift in the geopolitical calculus of all of this. As the Kurds grow in political and economic influence, Turkey weakens by definition. That's why Erdogan seems so unhinged when it comes to the Kurds. That's why you're seeing all of this playing out, and that's why Turkey seems so erratic.
Okay, let's transition the Kurds, from here.
Add on there just a second. It should also be mentioned that from very early in the crisis, 2012, Assad granted autonomy to Syria's Kurds, particularly the YPG, basically saying, all right, you haven't openly engaged with us. We can't protect you where you are at the moment. You're on your own. Good luck. To that date, the Kurds have not engaged with government forces.
With some small exceptions.
It's a war.
Yeah. I'm just pointing it out because someone would say, whoa, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. It's obvious now particularly in the Aleppo area, that the Kurds are and the Syrian Arab Army are coordinating as led in the coordination room by Russia, along with the Iranian and Iraqi militias and Hezbollah. The not only are the Kurds advancing in the east, but now there's a strong Syrian Arab Army push east as well, along highways to the Far East, basically a race for Raqqa. And they have advanced into Raqqa governance and are engaging a very important, trying to retake a very important air base on the western outskirts of Raqqa. And this is a very important race for what Eric exactly mentioned earlier. If there is to be some kind of invasion to carve off a piece of eastern Syria, perhaps parts of western Iraq, and make it into some kind of Syrian or some kind of Sunni Salafist caliphate, it will be in Raqqa. And both the Kurdish moves there and the Syrian Arab Army's sudden race towards Raqqa are an attempt to deny a place, basically, for the Saudis, the Turks, and the West to invade and to carve this piece out. So it's very important strategically in the long game.
And we'll watch this over the coming week and talk about it next week. Yeah. Let's move over now from the western flank to the eastern flank and the Korean Peninsula. Go ahead, Eric.
This is really interesting because, okay, so last week in our little bonus session of discussion, we talked about the ASEAN summit and how we need to understand ASEAN, what it is that the United States was trying to accomplish there, and basically all of the associated issues. And forgive me, I'm just trying to pull up the appropriate article here. But in the wake of all of that, and against the backdrop of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, against the backdrop of the Asia Pivot, against all of these things that are happening here, we have another issue that I think is of very important strategic significance, and that is the multi-missile systems into the Korean Peninsula at the request of the government of South Korea. And this system is called THAAD systems, THAAD systems. Now, this is basically, and I mean, I'm not going to get into all the military, specifics about it and get off into the weeds here, but basically, this is an advanced anti-missile defense, quote unquote, defense system, as incredibly all systems seem to be just merely defense systems. The United States is putting in advanced missile systems into Korea, into South Korea, ostensibly to protect against North Korea. However, if you read the actual papers that go into this, they say very clearly that only the southern tip of South Korea could possibly be protected by such systems. Why? Because North Korea is, right next door, and their missiles would get there within a minute or two. And so these systems are basically negligible in terms of the threat, so-called threat from the DPRK, from North Korea. And military experts, including Peter Lee, who's not a military expert, but probably one of the best followers of East Asian affairs and China over at the blog China Matters. Peter Lee wrote recently in the Asia Times exactly what I would have said from the very beginning, namely that this is directed against China. This is directed against the People's Republic of China, the military of the Chinese government, and basically this has to do with what we were talking about last week, all of the various conflicts in the region, including in the South China Sea, where the Chinese are attempting to establish or are moving in the direction of establishing an air defense identification zone, an ADIZ, which is, depending on who you ask, more or less a way of saying we control the airspace, or at least we have jurisdiction over this airspace. The United States seems to be countering with what I would call a multi-pronged geopolitical and strategic offensive. On the one hand, they use the ASEAN summit and sort of arm twist twist, their partners in Southeast Asia. On the other hand, they're using these very provocative tactics about the so-called freedom of navigation issue in the South China Sea as a way of justifying the placement of increased naval assets, pushing right up against Chinese naval assets, basically egging on the Chinese for some kind of a naval confrontation here. Now, what we have heard over the course of the last 1, 2, 3 years is how many significant advances the Chinese military has made with its technology and its ability to basically set the entire South China Sea on fire if it wants to. I'm obviously metaphorically speaking here. Now, this then leads us to this question. How is the U.S. militarily responding to that? And this deployment of the THAAD system is yet another way that they're doing that. Now, what this means is something very, very dangerous because the Chinese have already said publicly, if the U.S. and South Korea move forward with putting this system in, it can only lead to escalation. What that means, of course, is China will now have to up its missile capacity along the Korean Peninsula border. So we have a flashpoint in Southeast Asia with the South China Sea disputes. We have a flashpoint between China and Japan over the Diaoyu-Senkaku Islands dispute. And we have a flashpoint on the Korean Peninsula. And the last thing I want to say against the backdrop of all of that is, of course, oil and gas reserves. The South China Sea is considered to be one of the biggest untapped gas reserves in the world. The Chinese know it. The Chinese want it. That's why they have their advanced oil rig systems out in the South China Sea. The U.S. wants to deprive them of that. This is, I think, the geopolitical calculus for all of East Asia today.
Mark?
Yeah, I just note that this erection of anti-missile defense systems, AMD, in South Korea, of course, also presents a partial threat to Russia's own strategic deterrent systems.
Sure. Yep.
Because while the majority of Russia's strategic deterrents would, of course, go over the Arctic, toward the U.S., that's, you know, much closer. This is, of course, in parallel to the AMD, the, you know, ballistic missile defense systems, BMD, that the U.S. is putting in Eastern Europe, and in the Mediterranean, and potentially even in the Black Sea itself. This is just further rings of containment, and Russia is already reacting to steps like this, threats to its strategic deterrent, and basically, you know, restarting a nuclear arms race by announcing that it will put cruise missile capable ships, which Russia has recently demonstrated how effective they are, that could potentially have nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. They will continually rotate these cruise missile ships out of the Mediterranean, which is, you know, Russia's asymmetric way of saying, okay, put this up, it doesn't really affect us. This is on top, of course, of the submarine, the very substantial submarine force that Russia has, which, you know, makes the trifecta of, you know, nuclear strategic deterrent. But in the South China Sea, I'd also like to point that we had a U.S. admiral on board a U.S. warship, an aircraft carrier, in the South China Sea, on the other side of the Pacific from the United States, complaining about China militarizing the South China Sea off their own coast. Is the imperial hubris involved with that? What's more, they carried on, and the Pentagon spokesman claimed that the presence of U.S. warships could only be regarded as comforting, and that China's perceptions of that weren't relevant.
It would be Let me just want to say, you know, the symmetrical response would be, for example, China placing its naval forces in Long Island Sound or Block Island Sound or, you know, one of
at
those
least
places.
Off the coast of Baja.
Or no, even better, down in by Newport News, and then and looking at the U.S. naval base and saying that the U.S. is militarizing the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, I just want to note here, and I don't usually like to quote on this program, but I will just to sort of illustrate even further a little bit of what Mark was talking about, although I think he was going in a slightly different direction. This is from The Diplomat, which is a needless to say, yeah, and very closely aligned with
yes,
U.S. policy, U.S. political establishment. So this comes from The Diplomat, so not exactly a pro-China source. And it says, in regard to the deployment of THAAD missile systems, or it says, in terms of a THAAD facility, this guy, Sukjun Yoon from The Diplomat, says, quote, THAAD's range will extend beyond the Korean Peninsula. The coverage provided by the existing sea-based Aegis system will be greatly extended by the planned deployment of ANTRY, two radars, blah, blah, blah. Now, array sensor system providing a 120-degree field out to 1,000 to 3,000 kilometers, effectively covering the whole of mainland China. Does anybody doubt what this system is really there for?
Right. All right. So let's move on. We wanted to talk about Brexit. That's not a Brexit, and all of those things.
I don't have a ton to say about that.
Well,
so
I think
sure
Mark was picking that
more,
up. Yeah.
Yeah, a little more motivated on it.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. All right. Well, we had a meeting just in the last 24 hours, basically an EU crisis meeting. The Tory government in the UK has promised a referendum to its constituency for years on an open question to stay or to leave the European Union. And polls in the UK are pretty divided, but usually with the edge going to the portion of the population that would choose to leave the European Union. So there was this emergency meeting in the EU basically to offer enough to the Tory government to campaign for staying in the European Union, which both, you know, all three major parties in the UK, the political elite, you know, in control, you know, at least Cameron himself and his government, if not the Tory backbenchers, want to stay in the EU. This provides them with the special exceptions, the cookies, the rewards, that where they can claim some shreds of their own sovereignty to take home to the British voters and argue for staying in the EU. Although, you know, many people have rightly remarked that the UK already has one foot outside of it. But of course, there's the threat that, you know, giving these special exceptions to the UK and not to other countries could very well further cracks that will help lead to the dissolution of the EU, because why should they get some special considerations where other countries don't? And the other half of this meeting is, of course, under this FAW refugee crisis. And this was a big part of, you know, what was offered to the UK as well, because we know that the UK has been very much rejecting the ideas of being forced to take any of increased numbers of migrants or refugees through.
Color me shocked.
Yeah, color me shocked. We see a lot of rhetoric really getting quite nasty over this whole issue of the refugee crisis that was discussed at this meeting, including I think we've seen splits on the, shall we say, the anti-imperialist, the multipolar forces. This has become really very distracting and very destructive, I think, because what we've got is, particularly on the Western far left, we've got a lot of really nasty rhetoric coming out, basically accusing anyone who dissents from the idea that the Europeans should accept large numbers of migrants and refugees. And it should be pointed out that less than half of these are actually from Syria. Large numbers of them are actually from Albania, from Kosovo, and so on, Eritrea, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, the whole litany of failed adventurisms. You know, the rhetoric from the left is they should be accepted because of Western adventurism in their countries. And then there is an argument there, but at the same time, they make the argument that these countries aren't really democracies anyway. And so should the people in these countries be punished by, you know, the influx of large numbers of what, however politically uncorrected it is to say it, culturally alien refugees that the majority of the people don't want there without any referendum or everything? And we've seen a lot of rhetoric accusing anyone who takes a position against this being cast as fascists. I mean, we've had people saying that RT and Sputnik and other Russian media sources for discussing the issue in what I would say are somewhat a little bit hysterical tones, but that echo the mainstream press in much of Europe are fascist, or people who are aligned with fascists. And this is, of course, completely overblown rhetoric. I mean, first of all, it is historically, grossly, ideologically inaccurate. And it basically makes a mockery of their own arguments. I mean, can we please invoke Godwin's law here? These people, anyone who opposes this migrants are not fascists. Even Pegida are not fascists. And to say they are is just absurd. I mean, take a look at their – you may not like them. They can be correctly described as Islamophobes. They are certainly illiberal. But are they fascists? Just take a look at their, you know, their manifesto, what they're asking for. They actually have a fairly reasonable proposals regarding immigration. You know, simply you know, asking that it be controlled and regulated, while at the same time accepting war refugees and so on. So I think this is really destructive to the multipolar, the anti-imperialist movement in general. And I think the rhetoric really needs to be toned down on both sides on this. There are some things that we can disagree on.
Yeah, you know, hold on a sec. Let me go in here. First, on the one hand, the point being made that people that are taking this position are allied with fascists is true to a degree, because that is the position that the fascists are taking as well, and that's what they're working.
Are you talking about, you know,
Islamophobic?
Who are you talking about? Are you talking about the Banderites in Ukraine?
Yeah, for sure.
Wave SS banners?
Well, you know, I mean, and then there's the contradiction in the middle of all of that, because you have the most right-wing forces both in the United States and places like Ukraine and elsewhere that are openly in bed with exactly the Islamo-terrorists, quote-unquote, that they use as the figure of these people that are coming in, escaping wars that are being conducted by the Europeans and Americans against their countries. But on the other hand, the discussion that has to take place there, because if you'll remember what happened in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, there has to be a strong identification of the left as to where it stands on these questions. The left is supposed to look at class interests, and those are transnational and even transcultural. If these are working people that are being blown up by imperialism, we have to find a way, A, to stop imperialism from blowing them up, and B, helping them out. Now, that does not necessarily mean allowing people to come in groups of a million and do whatever, because guess what, by the way, the dynamics of that are not going to be democratically determined. The same people that are conducting the wars are going to be conducting and are conducting a lot of the actions on the ground there. But these are folks who are escaping, you know, many of them are escaping wars. Even Kosovo, those folks had their country blown up by NATO also.
There's a collection of issues here that need to be pulled apart. I strongly disagree with Mark's characterization. I think it's completely ludicrous, and I will address it in a second. Number one, there are competing narratives on the anti-refugee side of the so-called anti-imperialist movement. Number one is not every single person who wants to raise the issue and debate about how, you know, refugees and how many should be taken and all of that. Not every one of them is a fascist, and there there are different narratives within the umbrella of the anti-refugee camp or the, you know, the anti-EU or whatever camp. Okay, there are a significant portion of them who are pushing straight up Nazi conspiracy theory BS about this entire issue. They say this is a Rothschild Jew cabal lizard Freemason conspiracy to destroy Europe with refugees, with culturally alien, civilizationally different refugees who are going to come in and destabilize, and they took our jobs and all of this garbage. That is straight up Nazi fascist garbage that needs to be outright discredited, debunked, and I think anybody who pushes that narrative is a joke and shouldn't be taken seriously. Not some sort of, oh, well, we disagree about what the agenda. No, that is ridiculous garbage, and we all know the history of that and where that comes from and who propagates that and why, and we know exactly how the intelligence agencies love to propagate just that sort of garbage because of its divisiveness, because of how stupid it is, and because how easily ignorant morons get trapped into that sort of thinking. So that's number one. And actually, I will tell you right now, there are some people who are propagating precisely that narrative and couching it in the terminology of so-called multipolarity and couching it in the terminology of so-called Marxism-Leninism, if you can believe it. Left and right, you have elements of that. Now, what is that? That is fascist talking points dressed up as something else, and that needs to be discredited and debunked and exposed. Number two, WikiLeaks just came out with a very important leak of documents about the EU conducting military operations against refugees. Within that document, or within the leaked reports, it gave us specific numbers from the EU's own intelligence estimates, who's coming from where, how many, and so forth. Now, the Turkish corridor has increased by 1,665% in 2015, the number of refugees. This is exactly what I wrote in September of 2015 before anybody was talking about a so-called crisis. I said, Turkey is manipulating this for their own political reasons. That's really what's happening here. And the people who are pushing all of the other conspiracy theories, they are doing the work of the empire for them by distracting from the reality of what's happened here. Number two, if you and by the way, the Western corridor via Spain and North Africa and the Central corridor via Libya, if you look at the numbers from the EU's own estimates, they are minuscule. The vast majority come through Turkey. It's more than like 90% coming through Turkey. Now, here's the other question that has to be addressed here, and this is critical. You take all of those numbers, okay, all of those numbers put together, even a conservative estimate, it accounts for less, or actually exactly 0.01% of the European population. 0.01% Even if they were to multiply tenfold the number of refugees coming, it would account for 0.1%. This notion that there is a refugee quote-unquote crisis and that it is going to quote-unquote destabilize Europe is absolute nonsense. Number two, I totally reject what Marx said about Pegida. They are fascists. They are ethno-nationalist fascists, very similar to what we see in other parts. And I will also go further. Jobbik, the Hungarians, the various other strains in Europe, from the ridiculous clown Wilders in the Netherlands to the Swedish Nazis to all of these other groups, you could call them whatever you want. We know the history of fascism in Europe. We know the ideological construct from which they come, and we know how they're being used and manipulated either by Western intelligence, as they have historically, or increasingly today by various forces who have a different agenda for them, who want to use them for their own political purposes. Watch them hurling abuses at women and children in Germany. Watch them attacking refugees in Bulgaria, the so-called attack party and all of these other fascist elements. These are fascists. They need to be called fascists. It needs to be exposed unequivocally.
Okay, Mark, take like 2 minutes to respond, and then we want to jump into Maduro.
Yeah,
and we'll pick this up next week.
I think this is just silly. I'm not sure whether I'm talking to a leftist or a postmodern liberal, because that's the talking points here. Basically, accusing everyone who disagrees, oh, there's fascists here, there's fascists there, fascists behind the quarter, disagree with a policy on Islamic immigration into Europe, you're a fascist. This is just absolutely ridiculous. But I think the one thing two things that Eric and I can agree on are, first and foremost, that yes, Turkey has orchestrated a lot of this to their benefit to try to further their own promotion of direct Western intervention. And we've seen Erdogan outright blackmail European officials saying if they don't give him more money, this has been leaked from the meetings, that he will flood Europe with refugees.
And he's weaponized it against Greece, actually. I mean, he's been dumping refugees on Greece, and they are getting overrun.
So we can agree that this is obviously backlash from Europe's own actions, and we can have little sympathy with them there for that, at least with the elites in charge of the governments, whether it's Syria, whether it's Iraq or Afghani, large numbers of the refugees come from there, whether it's from Kosovo or Albania. I mean, this is, all related. Another thing Eric and I can agree on is we both want Europe to take as many refugees and immigrants as it possibly can, although probably for entirely different reasons. Eric thinks it's the right thing to do. I think that this is the best way to cause disorder in the EU. I think that it will the backlash of doing this undemocratically without even a referendum to give the publics their opinion on this really extraordinary situation is no better way to bring the far right that Eric is casting as Nazis into power. And that will inevitably lead to the fracturing of the EU. So I entirely support it.
I find it very interesting just how quickly Europe, which has been involved in destroying all of these places, has somehow been transformed into the victim, the people of Europe into the victims. It's sure fine when the migrant labor is cleaning the feces from under their elderly and sweeping their streets and doing all of this work. But when it somehow comes out in the open, their own culpability and all of this, all of a sudden there's a civilization to protect. All of a sudden they have to defend themselves from the quote unquote swarms and hordes and tidal waves and all of this other stuff. I reject all of that. The Greek Communist Party, the KKK, have a very clear and very good policy on all of this. I would urge anybody who really believes, either on the left or not on the left, who really wants to examine this, why don't you take a look at those who are actually on the front line of the refugee issue in Greece, who have the right position and who are actually gaining support not only of the refugees themselves, but of people inside of Greece because of precisely that position. I think that there's a model to be looked at there. KKK had the right position on Syriza all along. They demanded that people move away from the liberal, the social democrats, and from the extreme right Nazis of the Golden Dawn. KKK was right then, they're right now, and new forces in Europe need to take a look at that.
And that's where we'll pick this up next week. Let's jump into what's happening with Maduro.
Very quickly, very interesting developments in Venezuela. Number one, Maduro made a major speech this week announcing a raft of reforms, including a 6,000% increase in the cost of gas, which was like 1 cent per liter, and it had been for a long, long time. This is obviously to raise funds for an economy that is on the brink of collapse for a variety of reasons. I would also note that the replacement of the economic minister is significant. It had been what you might call a socialist intellectual, a professor, someone of a theoretical background. He has now been replaced by a more business oriented economy minister. This is obviously not only to placate the business owners inside of Venezuela, but I think this is also a move towards what could be called quote-unquote more pragmatic economic approach. Specifically, I think what needs to be looked at and what they're really focused on is the distribution networks, because part of the political crisis inside of Venezuela, which is connected to the economic crisis, has to do with the owning of distribution networks and consumer goods and consumer good shortages. In other words, artificial scarcity through manipulation of distribution. That's what Maduro was really pointing to. Very interesting. interesting development there in regards to the state-run supermarket chain, which has just been exposed for massive corruption. 55 government officials arrested last week over major corruption issues, including with the supermarket chain. What the government is now doing is actually devolving to local control, community control of the distribution networks for the state-run supermarket. Now, the neoliberal capitalists all over the world, of course, cry that this is a joke, this won't work, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, when I was in Venezuela and I saw how the communal councils work and how some of these communes work, I would say that they're probably far more efficient than the government was at distributing goods and in distributing food. I think that there's real potential here. And I think that we need to be very clear about what kind of a war and destabilization Venezuela is facing, stuff that I've elaborated a number of times, but I don't want to hog the rest of the time.
Mark, you got like a minute and a half. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just take a quick look up the border, U.S. Election update. We have seen polls coming out ahead of the upcoming caucuses and primaries in Nevada and South Carolina that show Trump on top of the Republican field by 20 points and Sanders neck and neck with Clinton. What's more, a U.S. Today Suffolk University national poll shows that a Clinton running against any and every Republican, major Republican candidate loses every single time. Whereas a Republican, a Sanders Republican matchups, Sanders loses every time, including to Trump, except for against Cruz, where he wins by 1 point. So the Trump tidal wave, agree with it, disagree with, he's making more and more sense at least on foreign policy. Maybe the Americans should just take a after inflicting the suffering on the rest of the world for years, to just take a little bit of suffering domestically at home for themselves to bring some sanity to foreign policy.
So the U.S. should, but Europe shouldn't, huh?
All right, we're gonna leave it there. Mark, Eric.
I agree. I think they should, Eric, because I want the EU to dissolve.
Wow. Hey, by the way, so does George Galloway, and I want to make sure we discuss that next week too. All right, Eric, Mark, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.